Great to be here. The first time that I'm at the Perimeter, and it's good to be here as an experimentalist. And I will try to give you a little bit of an insight of, I think, what it takes to build a quantum simulator for quantum field theories, and then, you know, give a little bit of an overview of some of the experiments we did lately. And I will not talk about any of these, the older things that we did on simulating quantum field theories, but I will try to go into things that are related to what might be here. Now, quantum simulators, of course, you know, always goes back to Feynman's original idea is to take a quantum system that simulate strongly correlated quantum systems. So basically the big problem is that how do we go on and learn about systems that are so strongly correlated that a classical computer doesn't have any chance of doing the calculation. And there are usually two different ways of building a quantum simulator. And we had by Christina in the morning, we had this fantastic talk about what can you do if I have a full-blown quantum computer. I put it on a quantum computer and try to do a throttle decomposition of the many-body evolution, and then I can simulate quantum systems, and it was shown that this is basically efficient, and you can simulate even strongly correlated systems. And I think the first step in this direction was this real-time dynamics of lattice gate theories, which was done in Innsbruck about now six, seven years ago, and how far it went you saw in the first talk, you know, by Christina this morning. There's a second way of doing quantum simulators, which is something that we were talking about a lot in the last few hours, which I think are analog quantum simulators, where you really build the desired Hamiltonian directly in the lab and prepare the ground state or and observe the time evolution. Examples of that are the Hubbard model, for example. And what I would try to argue is that there is a different kind of quantum simulator, which I think is even much more interesting, which I call emergent quantum simulators, where you start with a very complex many-body wave function. The complexity of the wave function does not allow you to observe everything, whereas in a Hubbard model, you know, I observe everything and I can do that, and it's a very simple model, so I can still build that. But you have the description of this of the complexity of the many-body wave function forces you, by coarse graining and Riemannization, to build an effective description. And this effective description can be completely different from the microscopic physics that are built in the lab. And that will give you some kind of a way to build a simulator for an effective description. And I will show you that we can do that for the Klein-Gordon and the Sein-Gordon model. And how to do that and how to verify that. And I will give another example of how to you know do that in hydrodynamics. So in this many body, where does it come from? First of all, I have you know the complexity of the many body wave function does not allow us to observe all the details. So what we can do, and I will show you that in a really complex system, you can only observe few body observables. Because for the other ones, the computational complexity of extracting the information is too large, and I can never do that. Yeah? And this measurement on this many-body system is always a coarse graining that leads you in the RG framework, as far as I, as a stupid experimentalist, can understand it, to some effective description of the system. This can be very different from the microscopic physics. And this is a natural way to describe many-body systems, is then through this emerging effective models, and they usually are field theories, yeah? And the question that I will ask is, how good are these emerging quantum simulators for these quantum field theories, and when and how do they break down? That would be interesting to find out. And a natural way to probe this is through measurement of correlations. And the question I would ask is, which quantum field theory do we simulate, and can we extract the parameters of this effective theory directly from the experimental data? Can I really directly extract it out from the experimental data? So a quantum gas is a beautiful many-body system, and it's allows you to get effective quantum field theories. And for us, you know, the temperature T equals zero state is a vacuum. The excitations are the particles that are on the system. Energy density corresponds to geometry, and you can think about what other things. And examples are, you know, the 1D superfluid and how it's related to a Luttinger liquid or a relativistic quantum field theory. And many of our old experiments in the last 15 years were really looking at the question, what can I look at a relativistic quantum field theory? Two tunnel-coupled superfluids get you into the Sankt-Gordon model, which is a strongly correlated quantum field. And there are many other examples you can think of. And the interesting questions is that, how does the microscopic physics relate to the effective quantum field theory description? And for instance, what does the granularity of the many-body system, does that correspond? What does this granularity of the many-body system correspond to? Is this something like a Planck scale or something? And so these are questions where I have no idea of, or no answer of, and I want to put them up here just to see and have a discussion. So I will try to concentrate in my talk on the Sankt-Gordon model, and then I will try to show you in a different way, if there is time in the end, how to make fermionic quasi-particles in a bosonic system. And really question that the Luttinger liquid phonons, if phonons are really a good effective description of the systems, at least for 1D, I will show you they're not. They're only for very short times a good description. And the fermions are the better description of that. So, Sankt-Gordon model, what is this based on? There was a beautiful paper now, some like 15 years ago, by Gritschew, Polkovnikov, and Demler, who conjectured that if I take two tunnel-coupled superfluids and have this very complicated microscopic Hamiltonian, and I make approximations like the density phase approximation, I expand the Hamiltonians in density fluctuations and phase gradients, I neglect all mixed terms and all higher order terms, they kept quadratic, and then they arrived at an Hamiltonian, which is the quantum Sankt-Gordon model, which is basically uncoupled harmonic oscillators, which is a Luttinger liquid, yeah, plus an aharmonic term, which has a term 1 minus cosine phi in there, and that gives you a gap in the system that gives the excitations a mass that basically leads to topological excitations and to non-Gaussian physics. So basically, you can say you take your two tunnel-coupled 1D superfluids, atomic superfluids, and in the end, when you get out the physics is of a field in this cosine type of potential. And then what is nice in there, that from the microscopic physics, I can basically uniquely determine the parameter of this quantum field theory. And it's characterized by something, that you have the phase coherence length, the spin healing length, like we had in the other types of systems that we discussed before, and so we can go on to do this. Now, I don't have to say anything that the Sankt-Gordon model is interesting for many different aspects of physics. It is usually written not in that form that I had written it down there for the experimental parameters, but it's some scaled form, and where you have this quantity beta, which has to be between 0 and square root of 8 pi, and this beta plays the role of a Planck constant, and beta much smaller than 1 being the semi-classical limit, the experiments I will show you are in the regime beta 0.1 to 1. So they are semi-classical to getting more into quantum. The Sankt-Gordon model can be mapped on many different interesting models, the massive tearing model from Sidney Coleman did the Coulomb gas, the XY model, half-inch spin change. So if you look at, in solid-state physics, many of the things of magnetisms can be mapped onto the part, and it's equivalent to extended Hubbard models, and it's also interesting, it's you can show that this basically describes string breaking and entanglement in expanding quantum fields. Now, how do we build that? So we built that on a device, which is an Atom chip, which allows you to make one-dimensional systems. And to be in one-dimensional system basically means that you have a longitudinal trapping frequency and then transverse trapping frequency. And what you want is that the temperature and the interaction strengths are much smaller than transverse trapping, so that basically that the transverse degrees of freedom completely freeze out. And we can reach that in the sense that we have temperatures being between 0.1 and 1 times interaction energy, and temperatures being in the order of between 0.1 and 0.7, the transverse trapping frequency. Now, then I have a really one-dimensional system, and I can split that into two, and when I split it into two, I can measure the phase difference between these two systems, and these two one-dimensional systems that I have here, that I show transversely here, these ones are basically the ones we will build our Sankt-Gordon model out. Now, how do I read out the experiment? In general, the experiments we do, so basically what we have an experiment, then we take some kind of we apply some unitary, and then we can image it. And when you image it, the best thing you can do, you can image every single constituent. Now, for optical lattices, there are these shiny pictures where people tell you they can see every atom. You can also do that for continuous systems. And that's a plot where you have about 2,000 atoms from a parametric oscillator in there. Yeah.
What is applying a unitary?
Oh, this that unitary is, for example, you can choose. You know, the simple thing as an experimentalist, you're lazy. It's either identity, then you image in situ, or it's time of flight, then you image momentum. Yeah? Now, but in principle, you could use any unitary, because afterwards, you evaluate your data, and you extract values, and you compare it with the theory. Now, and problem that I ask every theorist since about 10 years is that, give me the unitary so that I get my best information out of my experiment. I'm an experimentalist, I'm lazy, I do the simplest ones that I do. And discussing with many people, asking this question seems to be an extremely difficult question, and it might not be answerable, which unitary you want to find strongly correlated quantum system to get the most information out from the experiment. And so what we do is, what we measure are single-shot projective measurements of the many-body wave function. Yeah? So each measurement, single-shot projective measurement, and this is basically an endpoint function. This is a 1,000-point function that I measured here, from which is the one that I have. And I cannot basically analyze them because they are too complicated. So what would we do for our Sankt-Gordon experiment? We have a two-tunnel coupled superfluids. Then I have a few thousand atoms in there. Then I do I basically make time of flight, and I measure an interference pattern, and I can extract for each of these lines in the longitudinal direction, I can extract the phase difference between the two 1D systems, and that corresponds to the Sankt-Gordon field phi. So basically what I have is that in this measurement of the time of flight, I measure the field phi that will be the interesting part in my quantum field theory. And this is the quantum field of the Sankt-Gordon. And I have that at something like 40, 50, 60 points. I will have that field. Now, how do I know that thing? How would I go and analyze that? And I analyze it to correlation functions. And now the question is that I can pick different types of correlation functions. Quantum opticians would just pick e to the I phi. And as you will see later on, if you pick e to the I phi, they'll throw away the most interesting information. If you go there and do the math, if you do the phi phi correlators, if just the field correlators, yeah, then you find out that that these correlators are related to the quasiparticles of the systems, and the fourth order correlator is related to the quasiparticle interaction. Yeah? So, of course, but for that, the problem is that this phi is not restricted to pi, but that's exactly what I want, because in the St. Gordon potential, you know, the Gordon field can sit anywhere where it is. So I should have to be able to reconstruct the two pi's, and the two pi's will help me to reconstruct the topological excitations of my system. Now, if I have these correlation functions, I want to know what information is in there. And of course, this correlation function is characterized, they characterize the propagation interactions of this, of the degrees of freedom. And if I pick the right correlation functions, then I really say the excitations in the field. So in general, an nth-order correlation functions can decompose in something that's a disconnected part and a connected part. And the disconnected part is fully determined by all through order, lower order correlation functions. So it's basically useless information. And the real information that I want to get is a connected part of the information that that contains a genuine new information at order n. And if I get a connected part at order 10, that basically means I get a genuine 10 particle function. And I get information about genuine five particle interactions. Because a fourth order function gives you two particle interactions. Six order functions gives you three particle interactions, genuine three particles. That means genuine three particle interactions that I cannot decompose into two body parts. Yeah? Two body interaction parts. So if you do the experiment, you can take these functions and you see if I, in point A, I can measure the fourth order, the four-point function, and I can calculate the four-point function out of the two-point functions, and I see that the two are identical. Now, point A is a system where I basically don't have any tunnel coupling. So the average cosine phi, the average cosine of the field, is zero. So it basically means it's completely delocalized. Now, if I take a system where the average cosine phi is close to one, it basically means the system sits on the bottom of the cosine potential. It has it's a Klein-Gordon model with I can approximate the cosine with a quadratic field, with a quadratic potential for the quantum field. And then it's a Klein-Gordon model, a massive quantum field theory. And of course, because it's a quadratic field theory, it factorizes. And again, the connected part of the fourth order connected part is zero. Now, if I go to higher, somewhere in between where I see the non-trivial part of the cosine, I find out that there are strong connected parts in the correlation functions. I can plot that in the form of, you know, I can sum over all the connected parts and summarize it by the total correlation functions. And then if this is in the order of one, basically means that a lot of information is in the system. Now, this shows two experimental plots. The number one is extremely slow cooling. Extremely slow cooling means cooling something like two orders of magnitude lower than you normally do. And then you find out that basically, you know, and I can extract the parameters of my St. Gordon model completely independent for my measurements, and it just is smack on. If I cool faster, it doesn't fit, and it freezes in excitations here. And these are systems which have a topological excitation in there, and these are false vacuum states, because they have an additional energy, because coming from the topological excitations that are in the system. Now, I can look at correlation functions or I can look at full distribution functions. And I can take now one point in my field and measure the full distribution functions of the phase. Yeah? And this full distribution function, if it's Gaussian, it's a factorizing model. And if it's non-Gaussian, it's a non-factorizing model. This full distribution function has the same information like the correlation functions, yeah? Except that it's all mangled up. All other correlation functions go into these full distribution functions. Yeah? So you pick up what you want, and sometimes you see it. It's better to see things that happen in the full distribution functions. In the other part, it's sometimes better to see it in the correlation functions. And especially if you look at here, in the fast cooling and the slow cooling, you see if you look at the fast cooling case, you see that there are at 2 pi and minus 2 pi, there's full distribution functions of pi and minus 2 pi, and they're corresponding to these topological excitations or domain malls in the quantum field. Yeah? And so you have a system, basically, so these are topologically different vacuum states. Yeah? So this field and this field lives in two different, topologically different vacuum states. Yeah? And this field has a higher, this vacuum has a higher energy because it has the energy of the domain wall in there. Yeah? So you can do that for the sixth order, eighth order, or higher, 10th order correlators, and you can see that they fit together nicely. And what limits us is not the data, but it's the computational complexity of analyzing the data. So to get the 10th order connected correlator, using all symmetries that we have to calculate about 10 to the 5 terms we have to subtract. And to do that in a meaningful way on a large data set, we had to throw away every second point of our data. So we threw away most of, you know, we threw a very significant, and that basically speeded up by factor 2 to the 10, the calculation. And it took about a few months in a big cluster to do that calculation. Yeah, and that's because it's, if you have it very strongly analyzed, very strongly correlated, you have the problems of doing it. So in principle, that shows you that it's very difficult to get more than few body observables in a strongly correlated quantum field. Now, that's nice, and I plotted, you know, you plot one part, you know, experiment and your calculation and they fit together with, that's nice that these two systems are consistent. Now the question is, can I verify that I really have this type of model? So the question is that, can I extract the parameters of the quantum field theory directly from experimental data? And there, basically what you have to do, let's look at the four-point correlator. The four-point correlator is basically the disconnected part, which is the propagators, plus the interaction. And to do that, and what I really want to get out, I want to get out the interaction strength here. I want to get out this gamma 4, so I have to take away all the two-point functions, plus I have to amputate that the path that go into the four point correlator. I mean, there is something that's called, you know, 1PI correlations, and they are the building blocks for that. You know, how do we extract them? Now we have one problem that usually in quantum field theory this is done when you do it and when you have non-equal time correlators. Because then you can calculate the propagators in a very simple way, and you can decompose them. Now, our experiment gives you equal time correlators. And then in the beginning, it looked like that this is now very difficult in there. But it turns out that there is a beautiful paper that's now, you know, 25 years old by Christoph Wetterlich, who showed that you can make an equal time formulation of quantum field theory that's completely equivalent to the other one. Except it's extremely difficult to calculate. So you either have the choice of doing something that's impossible or very difficult to measure, and then simple to calculate, or you do something which I can measure, and the other thing is extremely difficult to calculate. And as an experimentalist, I was voting for the second one. Yeah? And it turns out that, you know, with Jürgen Berges and his students, they managed to really take this equal time formulation of Christoph and brought it in such a case that we can do the calculations and extract the values. Now, all of that is written in this PRX paper. And so basically, the measured connected correlators contain the distribution of these lags. To extract the information about the coupling constants in the scattering vertices, one has to amputate these correlators. This is best done in a momentum representation, which usually comes naturally out of the non-equal time correlators, but which we don't have. So we basically had to calculate many of these things and use our finite system. We have discrete momentum spectrum and transform the calculations into the spatial modes and go of that. And then in the end, you come up that you get the two-point correlator. You come out with automatically with energy momentum conservation, and you come out with propagators that are exactly the ones they would expect for a Sine-Gordon model. And then you can go and do the same thing for the four-point function and find the running coupling constants of the model. And the running coupling constants of the model, how does the coupling constants change depending on the different parameters and the different momenta? And so I think that's a good indication that this really looks like a Sine-Gordon model. And the next step that what we will do is trying to use techniques developed by Peter Zoller and others together with Thorsten, who was Thorsten Zache, and others to really learn the Hamiltonian behind the quantum field theory. And I can't show you that yet because it's not done. But just wait a little bit. I think it will be done. So basically what we will now have a way of really learning the Hamiltonian and hopefully learning also the Liouvillian later on to see how close the system is and how good the part is. Now, what are some applications that we did for this quantum field simulator? And let's see, I will talk maybe a little bit about the area law of mutual information in the quantum field theory. And then I will show a little bit about things, that came out in the morning discussions about, emergent, about Floquet engineering and things like that. So mutual information, this is if you take a system and separate it between A and B, the mutual information is basically what does system A know about system B, and that corresponds that the entropy, the phenomenon entropy of A plus the phenomenon entropy of B minus the phenomenon entropy of the complete system. So for that, I have to be able to extract the phenomenon entropy for the quantum field. Yeah, and to do that, I need the full density matrix, but I only measure one quadrature component. So I have to reconstruct the density matrix from our systems. To that, we developed a method which we call many-body tomography, where basically it allows us, with quench dynamics and the dynamics after the quench, to reconstruct the Wigner functions of the excitations, and from that allows us to reconstruct the density matrix. Now, this is extremely powerful, shows you here that even out of the, say, the green and the blue are basically something where the density matrix looks like a classical Gibbs state, but it has fluctuations. And out of the fluctuations, we can reconstruct that the system had recurrences. Yeah? So it's a very powerful tool to reconstruct the excitations that have in the system. Now, if I apply that, I find that there's one caveat in there. I can only do that if the evolution or if the state is Gaussian. Nobody knows how to do that if the state is non-Gaussian. So we did that not for the Sine-Gordon, but we did it for the Klein-Gordon. For the Klein-Gordon quantum field theory. Yeah? And then we build a Klein-Gordon, and with this quench dynamics, we measure the density matrix and reconstruct measure the phenomenon entropies, and then measure the mutual information. And it turns out that the mutual information is basically independent of the length. And what is also interesting, we can measure how long does the mutual information reach out about the system. And it turns out it's exactly the coherence length. That's why in a classical thermodynamic system, mutual information is zero. In a quantum system, it's not. It has a length scale associated with it, which is the coherence length of the system. And both of that we could show in that. Now, let me go to the part. Now, one of the things is that what we tried is that if you take now the St. Gordon model, and what you want is you want to put the St. Gordon model in the pi phase. Yeah? You can do that by Floquet engineering, because the Floquet engineering, you know, if you oscillate, if say if you oscillate your potential or your tunnel strength, you find that the effective tunneling can be negative. And if the effective tunneling is negative, that corresponds to the St. Gordon model being in the pi phase. Now, if I would prepare the initial St. Gordon model in the pi phase and quench it to the zero phase, I would start my field on the top. Now, if I make a little bit more complicated modulation, I can build exactly that type of system here. Yeah? And our goal was to observe that. The problem was is that there was too much heating. We could not really prepare that in the low energy. So even though when we were preparing the pi state, it was heating up too much for it to be able to do this type of experiments. So it would be nice to, you know, you could do all these beautiful things, but you know, with the St. Gordon field, and there would, but you know, it didn't work. So what we did is we, you know, made Floquet engineering for a simpler system, which is we took a system which is very far detuned, so it doesn't have any tunnel coupling, and restored the tunnel coupling by Floquet engineering, and could show that that out of a system which has no correlations, we can make a St. Gordon system that has correlations. And but for that, these modulations, the energy you put in the modulation and the frequencies are different. And so this worked in a nice way. It was, you know, it worked. Yeah. And we learned a lot about Floquet engineering. And I think we will go back and see if we can find the right parameter regime of really going there.
Could you go back to the previous slide? So when you said you observed too much heating, so when you do the Floquet engineering, or you have a few free parameters. What are your free parameters? The amplitude of the modulation?
The amplitude and frequency.
And basically, if you increase the amplitude, you also increase the heating.
Yes, but you need the amplitude to be high to get into the regime of the pi phase. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
And if you heat up the system, because you seem to not say that.
You have to go there. So if your amplitude is low, you stay here. You have to go to high amplitude to go to be able to go to the pi phase to bring the system in the pi phase.
And. Yeah, so if you do this, you heat up the system. What exactly is the consequence of this? Is it not just, could you think of this as the thermal pulse vacuum decay or seeded or?
No, you're always thermal because it takes infinite energy and infinite time to prepare a ground state. You're always in the thermal state. Experimentally, there's nothing, vacuum state doesn't exist. You cannot do it. Second law of thermodynamics prohibits it to get you there. It's always a thermal state. You simply cannot, you know, you cannot get rid of the second law of thermodynamics, even in the quantum regime. So it's always thermal, but you want to have it thermal so that it really stays up there in the false vacuum. If this energy you put in there is much larger than the dip you can make, you know, it's not an interesting system. Because you want to get the field to be tunneling out and not being thermally.
What did you use for the modeling? What did you use for the modeling? It's a numerical simulation.
No, it's an experiment. An experiment that heated up too much. This is simple Floquet. This is numerical modeling of a Floquet. If I do it for a non-interacting system, it works perfectly. It works perfectly. This plot is 6, 7 years old or something when we started to do that. Yeah? That's a perfect system. Yeah? We did it right after we did the St. Gordon experiment because we wanted to do the pi part, you know? But when you do it in an experiment, you see that it just heats up too much. And you see it by heats up too much, you see that you put a lot of excitations in there in this interference pattern. I can measure my excitations. Yeah?
Yeah, what indication is there that that's just a completely robust fact? or that in this experiment you can't modulate it enough to really stay in a nice
That's what came out of the lab, and we tried for half a year, and couldn't find the parameter regime. Yes.
Have any theorists been checking?
Then we went back to understand flocane engineering better for an interacting system, and now we can after understanding that and after having a theory for that, at that time when we did that there was no theory for a flocane system in interacting part, yeah, that was just too naive. Yeah.
So did the theory also confirm that it's just kind of a general thing that you can't?
Yes, if you talk to somebody like Maxim Sabin or something, that in this parameter regime they expect that it's not protected, yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. So maybe also to a little bit of that. You know, decay of self-trapping or some other ways of decay, our ideas that we had of looking at, first stages of this this way system that we can do. So if you take your sign garden, the tunnel double, and you can detune it in such a way, we can basically make it that everything sits in one of those wells and nothing sits here, yeah? And then we can see, what happens, does it go over? If it's 0D, it should not go. There's self-trapping. In 1D, there's a decay of the self-trapping state. And you can see that in a beautiful way, the decay of the self-trapping state. You can measure phase, and you can measure density. And you can also measure the energy that's put in there, which are these two side peaks. So basically, when you tunnel, it basically means there's pair tunneling to the barrier, and that gives you the part, because a single particle cannot tunnel out there because the bosonic nature of the microscopic physics prevents you from that to do it. Yeah? And so you see the shoulders here, which come from the pairs, but the system was not good enough to show that these are really pair tunneling. And so we didn't have enough control, that we didn't really know how much of that is thermal activated over the barrier and how much of that is tunneling. Because it would be tunneling in a pair tunneling, we measure this pair tunneling, that would be shown that this has to be the pair tunneling that goes through. Yeah? Yes, so this didn't work out. Now, yeah, let's see. There are many other, for the simple Luttinger liquid type of systems, we did a lot of other quantum field theory experiments. But maybe let me end. So there's a lot of things that we might want to do further on, and I think we can prepare the Sankt-Gordon model quite quite close to the vacuum state. But let me go there and shed some light on there. What is the effective description of a system? And that sometimes you can be wrong. And this has to do with the emergence of, in 1D systems, there was some nice things that happened in the last few years, that the description of a 1D system, there was something that's called generalized hydrodynamics that came out there, where you basically, is a hydrodynamic description of the thermodynamic beta ansatz. And what you have here is that you can write down an hydrodynamic equation and on the macroscopic scale, and what it tells you is that this description tells you that the relevant excitations are rapidities and they are fermions. Yeah? And what are these rapidities? The rapidities are the propagation of particles, including the Wigner time delay. Now, what does it have an effect on the physics that we can observe? To look at that, we did experiments on seeing, how long does an excitation live? Now, if this is a nice quantum field theory in 1D, this excitation should live very, very long. It turns out they didn't. They decay pretty fast. And we can make now single excitations, yeah, show from the Fourier spectrum that this is only one excitation that we excite, but nevertheless, it's fast damping. Yeah? And funny of all, if you take latential liquid, your relativistic quantum field theory, your favorite relativistic quantum field theory, it doesn't describe it at all. If you take generalized hydrodynamics, which goes on from the beta answers of the 1D system, it describes it perfectly. Now, I want to understand why is that. Now, we looked at that at different excitation energies, and you know, if you have 1D and your excitation energy is too high, you can excite transverse modes, and you go into 3D, and then things should relax much faster. Now, generalized hydrodynamics is a pure, perfect 1D theory, and nevertheless, in regimes where the temperature is twice h bar omega, so you're very far away from 1D, it describes it perfectly. Why is that? Because in a box trap, the fermions, the fermionic quasi-particles fill up the complete Fermi C. And if you have the complete Fermi C filled up, it prevents relaxation of the system. Yeah? So even though it should be the simple-minded latential liquid model would give you extremely fast relaxation, it still is described by a perfect one-dimensional system, but the excitations are not bosons, it's not bosonization, it's fermions. Yeah? And you can see, so what does the decay, why do the bosons, the phonons decay? Because phonons are composed of a whole set of rapidities, yeah? And these rapidities deface. So what you see is not the decay of an integrable system in here, but it's just because I have the wrong effective theory. If I have the right effective theory, it's integrable. If I have the wrong effective theory, it defaces. And that's just as a kind of and if you want to look at the details, you can look at our PRX paper from these. So that's as a caveat. You have to be careful of, I think, which field theory you built and what are the constituencies and how does it look like. And, you know, we're lucky that, you know, our original experiments that we did we used the bosonic parts, which were all short timescale experiments, well, this doesn't really matter. Yeah? But if you would do experiments where it starts to be long, then this starts to matter, and the latential liquid or the bosonized relativistic quantum field theory is not the correct description. Yeah. Now, let me just finish. I'm basically done. Yeah.
Okay.
So I think it's important for these quantum simulators to look at what does emergence mean in quantum physics. And I think it's, if you have many interacting quantum particles, you know, the characterizing and controlling in full detail is completely impossible. So it automatically leads to loss of information, reduction to relevant information, and emergence of novel descriptions. And so what you have is that, say, you get something like, you know, effective field theory. And if you have additional things like local conserved quantities, you get to from an effective field theory to a hydrodynamic theory. And another typical part that comes out from this coarse graining would be universality, where I didn't have time to talk about it. And there will be many, many of these sets of coarse graining, and I think it leads automatically without any mystery to the you know, emergence of classical physics. And I think to find that out, I think in our experiment with ultra-cold gases, since we can measure every constituent with unit efficiency, you are perfectly chosen. You have a perfect system to study this. How do these emerging theories come out, and what can I learn from them, and how good are they? Yeah? And only then I can use them for simulating something. I have to be, you know, at least I have to trust them, what they are. Yeah. And so what have we learned? I think higher-order correlations and full distribution functions give you, you know, really nice insight into the many-body system. We showed that the Sangordon model from the correlation functions looks, you know, really the one that two-tunnel coupled superfluids can be built from. We identified the topological excitations and domain walls in the system. We extracted the parameters from external data, and we compared two emerging descriptions of 1D systems, which is a latential liquid, and the fermionic excitations coming from GHD. And I think this allows us to build and probe quantum fields in the lab as emergent quantum simulators, because they are the quantum simulators that you have are different from the microscopic physics. And yeah. It's not me that did the experiment. And as you see, there are probably more theorists on there. And then there are the experimentalists.
All right. Let's all thank Jörg for a nice talk. And, okay. Sophie had a question.
Fantastic talk. Coming back to the generalized hydrodynamics, can I not play devil's advocate and say, look, if I look at the decay of your excitations, the effective field theory is just one where you have an effective damping. And if I then can describe everything consistently, it just means that is the effective field theory for this observable. Would that not be correct?
I mean, I would not trust anything that I measure on that effective field theory for times longer than, say, the propagation time of a single excitation through the system, you know, for very short times. I would not trust it because you get, you know, if it's really the system and if it's integrable, and you would have, each, they should have, you know, in fact, is that the phonons in 1D live not as long as the phonons live in 2D. Which is strange, it's very strange. It has to do with the specific quantum physics of the beta ansatz and of the 1D systems. Yeah? And the only thing I wanna say is that, you know, we have to be careful if we use these quantum simulators for doing something with them, yeah? We have to really understand them more than just, you know, okay, I can neglect this and this and this and this term, yeah? You really have to go and go up there and then because otherwise, you know, yeah, at least that's my, and also find it, you know, from the physics point of view, extremely interesting, you know? I find it cool to have something where the excitations are fermions in a bosonic system. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for the very nice talk. So when you couple these two BECs through the tunnel effect, is it, do you expect to see some sort of Josephson effect, or is it?
I didn't understand you acoustically.
So what are the similarities with the Josephson effect in superconducting, you know, when you couple two superconductors through a tunnel over here, you get the Josephson effect. Here, it looks like there are a lot of similarities, or is it actually what you're measuring, or is it different?
So I'm sure that if you do the same thing with two superconducting wires and have a uniform tunnel coupling between them, and you can measure along the superconducting thing locally, you would also find the Sangwan model. Hmm. And it's probably written in Jamarki's book about 1D systems and about magnetism and things. Yes. Okay. But here we have, you know, we have the chance of really grabbing at it and measuring it in all the details. You know, except, you know, the Fluke engineering is very similar to what people did for Shapiro effect. Except there they, you know, they could not look at the time evolution shorter than the oscillation frequency and things like this. And so a lot of it is very similar or very much related to what you could do in solid state with the Josephson, yes? And it would be, you know, probably there are systems where some of these things you can do much better there if you have enough control about it. Yes? It also fits the same physics. It's, you know, superfluids, you know, of superfluids of Cooper pairs. Who cares, you know? As long as you don't see that they are pairs, but you see them as a point particle, it should be very similar.
Thanks very much for a fascinating talk. I just have a question about the 10th order correlators stuff. So this is a cosmologist question, I'm sorry. So if you do the full 10th order correlator calculation, how much of the information in the underlying field can you reconstruct? Is that a complete reconstruction, or is there other information left that
you need
to go to even higher order for?
Yes. So I didn't show you the interaction strength for the generate three-body interaction because it's too complicated. Yeah. So we were barely able to get the vertices out. Yeah. Probably if you have, you know, more control of the system, if you can do really TT prime correlators, but in cosmology also, you have the micro background, you have an equal time correlator system, yeah? Mm-hmm. And what can you get out? You know, I don't really know. That's why we want to measure the Hamiltonian, because that might be a different route to get to there, yeah? I think it's a complete open question. You know, the first time I ever talked about correlation functions, Peter Zoller was sitting in front of me and I said, Jörg, this is all very nice. You know, can you measure the Hamiltonian? Can you measure the thing? And I have to tell him, no. You know, after 6 years, we were able to at least to get out the vertex. Yeah, it's a question to all the theorists here. You know, we have a good idea of an efficient algorithm to get it out. We tried. We have the data. Yeah, yeah. It's very, you know, yes. It would be fantastic to do it, but I don't know. Yeah.
In correlators for. Bose-Einstein condensates. Thanks very much for the nice talk. Also on the topic of the correlation functions, you emphasize it's important to look at delta phi rather than like exponential of I delta phi or something like that. How do you actually access that observationally? Because I naively would have assumed you can only measure like trigonometric functions of the delta phi. Do you have to do some kind of unraveling reconstruction of the phase field, or how does that work in practice?
That's a very good question. So you saw that as long as I don't have any of these topological excitations, that the phase profiles are relatively smooth and I can reconstruct them. Now, if I have a topological excitation, these topological excitations can be very small. Now, if they are smaller than my resolution, I might miss them. That is a serious problem. And for that, we would try to, you know, expand and try to make different ways of different unity operators we can measure with higher resolution. But in the end, it's always a question of the coarse graining, yeah? And also, so you have one coarse graining, which is the one that gives you the St. Gordon, but then in the measurement of another coarse graining. And this is another RG step, which is very complicated and which we basically just managed to do in the last half a year with Torsten and Peter for their Hamiltonian reconstruction. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a hard question, and it works. It's, you know, for some things, you know, when you get there where the domain walls, the thickness of the domain walls is big enough, then I can beautifully see it. If they get too small, if you get too much close to the Klein-Gordon case, it gets very difficult. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Okay. Silky had a question, and then I think we'll call it a day. Oh, go ahead.
Okay. Well, perhaps because a good way to end the day, perhaps not the most optimistic way, but you seem to hint at a saying is as a question, a very deep question, is how much do you trust any, including your own experiments, and can you ever be certain about something? So.
Number one, as an experimentalist, you always have to detrust your experiment in a certain way. And then in the end, you know, if you're convinced how much you can trust it, you have to believe it even though if it completely contradicts theory. Because otherwise you will never, you know, if somebody tells you what it should be, so with the Hamiltonian learning, we will now only compare what we get out from the experiment and we get it from the theory after everybody says, that's it. And then we compare it, and then we see if it is. Otherwise, we have too much, we fear to having too much bias and stopping at the time when you did it. You know, precision measurements, if you talk to anybody who makes precision measurements, they basically only when they have the paper written, they unblind the number. And the same thing I think you should do here, too, in some kind. I think that's from an experimental point of view. I don't know if all experimenters, but it's hard. It's, you know, but only then I can trust what I do. You know, especially if I want to put then some big out some big claims that this simulates that. Yeah? Yeah? If somebody says, no, I've simulated high-DC superconductivity, you know, I will ask him, why do you believe that? Only because the two curves lie on top of each other? No. Yeah? Yeah? But when you do that, and you don't fit with theory, then you can also claim and say, guys, you know, there's a problem. Yeah? And only then I think you learn something.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for the talk, Jörg. Let's thank him one more time.